bashfully. "Oh, goodness, I've embarrassed you," she apologized. "Maybe we should talk about something else, like Boindil suggested. The Alfar, or Keenfire, or even about the Outer Lands. The two of you have been there, haven't you? What's it like?" "Foggy," said Tungdil with a wry smile. His mind travelled back to their expedition to the Northern Pass, and he described how he and Boindil had left the safety of Girdlegard and wandered for hours in the fog. A shiver ran down his back. Mir hunched her shoulders as if she too could feel the sinister fog. "I don't know how you kept your cool in such a dreadful place. I would have charged around in a panic and tumbled into a crevasse. It's a shame we don't know more about the dwarves who live there. What did you call them? Undergroundlings?" "They're hardly mentioned in our records." Tungdil looked at her intently. "How old are you, Mir? You know an awful lot." She beamed. "I'm still young. 104 cycles. I can't really remember my parents. They were killed by rockfall when I was a child. My adoptive parents were new to the realm. They brought a lot of books from their kingdom. Miraculously, the volumes survived the journey through the pond, and that's how I learned to read. I studied those books until I knew every line and every rune by heart." "No wonder you know so much." "That was just the start," she said, smiling. "After that, I wanted to read more. I must have knocked on every door in the city, asking for books. I was so busy reading that it didn't occur to me that dwarves are supposed to be metal workers and warriors." She laughed. "There goes Mir, carrying her books," she said, putting on a mocking voice. "Isn't she skinny?" She gave him a dig in the ribs. "Imagine my satisfaction when I found myself stitching the wounds of the dwarfs who teased me for reading. I took my time with those stitches, I can tell you." She mimed, pulling the needle very slowly through the skin. "Ouch!" exclaimed Tungdil. "But tell me, did your real parents have... I mean, did you get your..." He broke off, wondering how to frame the question. Mir seemed to know what he meant. "Did my parents look like albino rabbits?" "Yes, my parents and my grandparents were freelings. They were born in our realm. I think the paleness comes from..." "Generations of living underground," chimed in Tungdil excitedly, pleased to see his hypothesis confirmed. "Salamanders are the same." It occurred to him belatedly that the comparison was likely to cause offence. Fearing that Mir would be angry, he fell over himself to explain. "I expect you're right," she said, sharing his excitement. "Most of my kinsfolk never venture to the surface. Why would they? Our realm is more than big enough. We're not accustomed to living in traditional dwarven strongholds. It's a good thing the Fifthling Kingdom is just around the corner. I can hardly wait to find out what it's like." "Right now, it's unfinished," said Tungdil, thinking of the construction work. He was more interested in talking about the Freelings' realm. "What's your architecture like?" "You'd like our cities. Lots of multi-storied stone buildings in great big grottos with skies of rock and twinkling gems. We've got lakes as well, and some of my kinsfolk can fish from their windows. They set up their rods and wait for a bite." Tungdil couldn't begin to imagine what life would be like without the Freelings. Still, it was good that Mir had spoken of cities in the plural. Gemmel had more than one settlement in his realm. "How many dwarves?" Laughing, she got to her feet and held out her hand. "Come on. The others will be wondering where we've got to. I've given away too many of our secrets. You'll have to visit us if you want to learn more." Tungdil clasped her hand and allowed her to pull him up. She was stronger than she looked. "It probably comes from carrying stacks of books." At the campfire, Boindil was sitting watch. He nodded as they approached. Tungdil went over and gave him a warrior's hug. Boindil, relieved to be forgiven, thumped him on the back.
I always talk nonsense when I've been eating cheese, he growled. Next time you see me with cheese in my mouth, remember not to listen.
Thanks for the tip, said Tungdil, laughing. I'm glad we're friends again. He lay down beside the fire and glanced at Myrmeander, who had been watching them through the flames. She smiled at him, just as Belindis had smiled at him across another campfire, not so long ago. Southern entrance to the Fifthling Kingdom. Girdlegard. Spring, 6235th solar cycle. The orc touched down on the other side of the boulder and ducked out of sight. A light northerly wind blew toward him from the gateway. Flaring his nostrils, he sniffed the air. Nothing untoward. He peered out from behind the boulder to get a better look. The gates were wide open and unguarded. He could walk right in without anyone trying to stop him or sound the alarm. With a satisfied grunt, he straightened up and lumbered toward the tunnel, picking his way between the scattered boulders and ruined masonry. One of the two routes into the Groundling's kingdom, the southern approach, was more direct. The other route entailed leaving Girdlegard and entering the kingdom from the outer lands, which Ushnots was reluctant to do. The orc smiled. The prince would be well pleased with him for finding the southern entrance before the other scouts. Splashing carelessly through puddles of meltwater, he stopped at the gateway, poked his head into the tunnel, and sniffed the air for groundlings. His lips drew back in a smile. Stepping away from the gates, he unhooked his horn and sounded a long, clear signal that echoed through the range. The prince's bugle sounded in reply, telling the scout to keep watch at the entrance until the troops arrived. The orc decided to take a break. By locating the southern entrance, he had spared the troops a testing march over snowfields and glaciers, and it was time he had a rest. Grunting contentedly, he retreated to the shadow of the peaks, sat down on a boulder and rummaged through his bag, bringing out a Hessian sack containing the remains of a fleshling. The man had been unusually tall, too tall for one sitting. So he had saved his shanks for the journey. His mouth began to water at the festering smell. Spoiled meat was particularly flavoursome. He sank his teeth into the left shank, ripping off a sizable chunk, which he chomped through with gusto. The taste of fleshling brought back memories of the recent feast in Goregar, when Bruron's army had tried to trap them in a glade. On Ushnots's instructions, the orc and his fellows had drunk the dark water from the pond, broken down the barricades and run riot through the fleshling's ranks. The victory had kept them in meat for orbits. He tore off another strip of flesh and swallowed greedily, forgetting to chew. The meat slipped halfway down his gullet and came to a halt. Cursing, he whacked himself on the back, but the meat refused to budge. By now he was coughing and spluttering quite violently, so he reached for his drinking pouch, which slipped through his fingers and dropped to the ground. The pouch rolled down the hillside, with the orc chasing after it, taking wild, ungainly bounds. After a few seconds, he gave up and raced to the clear blue pool at the bottom of the waterfall. Throwing himself onto his belly, he lowered his head to the surface and drank. Cool water streamed down his throat, clearing his gullet. He took another gulp and realized that he was lying on a flat slab of rock above a trough measuring half a pace across. It looked like a conduit or a drain. Having no interest in waterworks or dwarven engineering, he lowered his head for another sip. This time he stopped in surprise, transfixed by his reflection. Staring back at him was a wrinkled face with a bushy blonde beard, a silver helmet, and long wavy hair. There was only one explanation. The pool was under the curse of the groundling god.
I shouldn't have drunk the water, he thought frantically. It's turned me into a groundling.
He squawked in terror.
Ushnots will kill me on the spot.
His panicked mind was still whirring when the watery face began to smile. A moment later, it stuck out its tongue. The orc stopped howling and leaned toward the surface.
Ugh!
He wrinkled his nose in disgust.
I even smell like a filthy groundling.
Eyes fixed on the gently rippling water, he stared at his reflection. To his astonishment, a second dwarven head appeared on his shoulders, and, above that, two brawny arms and an axe.
A proper entrance,
grunted Ushnots in satisfaction. He climbed onto a flat-top boulder to get a better view.
Fastok has done us proud.
Runshak took up position beside him and surveyed the sloping ground. A few boulders and some crumbling fortifications, but no cover to speak of. His brow furrowed as he spotted Fastok reclining near a waterfall, helmet pulled low over his eyes, and legs stretched out comfortably.
The bungling idiot's gone to sleep, he grunted,
picking up a fist-sized stone to hurl at the dozing scout. The missile missed its target, flying past Fastok's privates and landing near his feet.
Hey!
Bellowed Runshak.
Why aren't you keeping watch, you soft-skinned fleshling? Get the troops into formation, commanded Ushnots, encouraged by the hush. Advance with caution until we know what's what.
His troop leader, a broad-chested orc who stood 2 paces tall, drew himself up and relayed the orders to the troopers, who were strung out along the track behind him like an enormous metallic snake.
The plateau's too small, he observed. They'll have to advance in waves. So this is our new kingdom, muttered the orcish chieftain, lifting his head to survey the mighty peaks. It isn't as homely as Taboribor, but it's better than being hounded by Malin and his men.
His plan was foolproof. First, his army would occupy the abandoned kingdom and secure the old defences. Then, half of the troopers would stay behind to guard the gateways, while the remaining units paid a visit to the settlements in nearby Goragar. Ushnots needed provisions, and he was counting on the fleshlings to hand them over quietly. The king of Goragar wasn't likely to come to his subjects' rescue. His army was weaker than Malin's, and his troops were tied up in Jon Balsur, which lay within the kingdom's bounds. While the Alfar remained undefeated, Ushnots would be free to consolidate his empire without interference from the fleshlings. Afterward, neither the allies nor the Alfar would be able to oust him from the mountains, and he would reign victorious until the end of time. He had taken measures to ensure that the dark water wouldn't run out. Every trooper was carrying a full drinking pouch, and his quartermasters were bringing additional barrels and kegs. Ushnots intended to empty the contents into an underground basin and create his own lake. The water was actually quite palatable, and a single sip sufficed to renew the effect. He watched as his troopers filed onto the plateau and lined up before the gates.
My new kingdom, he said proudly, whinnying with laughter.
The troopers saluted their leader, cheering, banging their shields, and raising their weapons. In spite of the commotion, Fastok was still asleep. Snarling angrily, Runshak bore down on the unfortunate scout.
Hey!
He shouted, kicking him in the ribs. When Fastok failed to respond, he ground the heel of his boot against one of his shins. No creature could sleep through such agony, but Fastok didn't stir. Runshak frowned, his ugly features contorting suspiciously as he bent down and snatched the helmet from Fastok's head. The scout would never rise again. His skull had been spliced from the crown to the bridge of his nose by a weapon that Runshak judged to be an axe. A second blow had parted his head from his shoulders. The killer had positioned the corpse over a crack in the rock, allowing the dark green blood to drain away. With the helmet off, the head rested loosely against the neck, rocking gently from side to side. Runshak leaped up.
"On guard!" he yelled. "We're not..."
A lone dwarf appeared in the gateway.
"Come no closer," he warned him. "Fracas's children protect these mountains. Turn back or face their wrath."
He set a bugle to his lips, sounding a pure, deep note that resonated loudly through the range. There was a loud crack, and the mountains seemed to shudder beneath the orc's feet. Ushnots watched in horror as thin black lines zigzagged across the plateau at lightning speed, creating a network of fractures that augured badly for the orcish troops. The ground shook again, as if struck by an almighty hammer, and the plateau caved in, taking with it 1,000 or so orcs. Shrieking and snarling, they disappeared from view. A loud splash indicated that they had landed in water. 3 paces below the ground, the dwarfs had extended the plunge pool beneath the waterfall to create a deep basin with precipitous sides. The orcs were trapped. Ushnots watched as his troopers sank beneath the surface, dragged down by their armor. Some were hit by falling debris, while others clutched at the sides of the basin, claws scraping helplessly against the slippery rock. The dark water had made them immortal, but it couldn't stop them sinking over and over again.
"Since when is the Grey Range back in the groundlings' hands?" thought Ushnots, shaking with shock and displeasure.
The only way around the basin was via a narrow path, barely 4 paces across. On the other side, directly in front of the gateway, stood Runshak.
He was a tough orc, made tougher by the dark water, but he couldn't be expected to hold out against the groundlings while the rest of the army advanced 4 abreast around the pool. "The groundlings were waiting for us."
It occurred to Ushnots that he might never set foot in the groundlings' kingdom, let alone claim it for himself. Of the orcs on the plateau, barely 100 had survived, and they were looking to him nervously, reluctant to advance in case they met the same fate as their comrades. From the pool came high-pitched wails as the orcs continued to flounder in the water, unable to die. The noise redoubled as a battalion of dwarfs poured out of the gateway, their shouts and cheers echoing between the peaks. Blind panic descended on the remaining orcs. At the sight of the grimly determined, axe-wielding dwarfs, they turned tail and fled, forgetting that the dark water had given them unnatural strength. In their headlong charge to safety, they collided with the next orcish unit, which was making its ascent. Unsettled by the noise from above and the sight of their fleeing comrades, the next wave of troopers took off down the mountainside as well. In the chaos, the shouts of the orcish lieutenants went unheeded. Ushnots liked to think of himself as a cunning tactician. He was about to give the order to pull back and regroup when a slender figure detached itself from the rocks.
"You're not scared of a handful of groundlings, are you?"
demanded a female elf. She was wearing a half-mask and a veil of black gauze.
"I count 200 groundlings to your 5.
She paused and glanced at the flailing troopers in the pool.
"Sorry, 4,000 orcs."
Ushnots rounded on her.
"What is it to you?" he snapped. "Have they kicked you out of John Balsur already? Well, the Grey Range is mine."
He pointed down the mountainside.
"Get out of my sight before I show you what happens to Alfar who trespass on my land."
"Your land? As far as I can see, the Grey Range belongs to the groundlings," she said with a scornful laugh. "You're lucky I'm here to help."
Reaching over her shoulder, she drew an axe. Ushnot saw the glittering diamonds on the blade
and stepped back with a snarl, almost losing his balance.
"You're familiar with the axe, I see,"
observed Ondori, holding Keenfire aloft.
"Groundlings of the Grey Range,"
she called, her voice clear and the shimmering gems on the axe commanding the dwarves' attention.
"Your fabled weapon is in the hands of John Balsor's Alpha. Its bearer is dead."
The announcement had the desired effect. The charging dwarves stopped in their tracks.
"Well," said Ondori to Ushnots, "this is your chance. Send in your troopers and finish them off."
Ushnots hesitated.
"What if they've laid another?"
Ondori responded so swiftly that the orcish chieftain didn't have time to raise his sword. Keenfire whirred through the air, hewing his neck in a single blow. His head, complete with helmet, hit the boulder, bounced, and rolled down the mountainside. As if in defiance of the Alf, Ushnots stayed standing, blood gushing from his neck. Ondori kicked him in the chest, and the rest of his body followed his head. The gory blade rose through the air, tip pointing toward the startled Runshak, who had witnessed the death of his chieftain from afar.
"Orc!"
Ondori called out to him.
"You're their leader now. Next time I won't be so merciful. Tell your troopers to attack!"
Runshak immediately gave orders for the army to attack, and the orcs advanced cautiously. Ondori bounded down from the boulder, alighting in front of the dwarves, who drew back, eyes riveted on the legendary axe. They were talking in hushed tones, and their bearded faces were stamped with dismay. The Alf felt a wave of revulsion.
"I killed your hero," she told them coldly. "Tungdil Goldhand and his companions met their deaths in the lonely woods of Lacintiel. And you..."
She tilted the axe toward one of the dwarves.
"You'll die as they did, killed by the weapon that you forged."
Four dwarfs stormed toward her, but their bravery was in vain. A flurry of arrows ripped through the air, and the warriors toppled backward into their comrades' arms. It was clear from the black shafts protruding from their chainmail that the Alf was not alone. A unit of Alvish archers was hidden among the boulders, ready to loose fire on the dwarfs. As if the dwarfs weren't sufficiently intimidated, Ondori raised the axe and slashed at the nearest warrior. The blade passed effortlessly through the hastily raised shield, cleaving the arm behind it. The wounded warrior stared at his bleeding shoulder, paralyzed with shock.
"Groundlings are gifted metalworkers," she said, laughing vindictively. "See how cleanly the weapon slices through your flesh."
The air quivered, and five dwarves fell to the ground. Runshak grunted an order, and the orcs charged at the defenders, weapons raised. Ondori stepped aside, not wishing to be sandwiched between the troopers and the dwarves. The main part of the mission was over. She had staked a claim to the underground halls. Watching in satisfaction, she saw that the groundlings were already losing ground. It was exactly as the immortal siblings had predicted. The news of their hero's death was more crushing than the sight of 5,000 orcs. Without their usual confidence, they would be hard-pressed to resist the invaders' superior might. Meanwhile, orcish reinforcements were surging onto the plateau and stampeding toward the gateway, their fears forgotten now that victory was in sight. Ondori jumped onto the rocks where her companions were unleashing their feathered missiles at the defenders. Their aim was deadly. Each of the arrows killed or wounded one or more dwarves. Slowly but surely, the defenders fell back. At last their front line regrouped to form a semicircle barely 10 paces from the gateway. A unit of dwarves, bearing crossbows, stepped out of the tunnel. Ondori realized that the dwarves were preparing to close the gates.
"Look!"
she said, alerting her archers. Feather them with arrows before they lock themselves inside.
The Alfar took aim, drew back their bowstrings, and sent a flurry of missiles over the heads of the invaders. The bombardment stopped when the last dwarven archer went down. Onduri waved angrily at Runshak.
What are you waiting for? Get your troopers through the gates!
Once closed, the gates could only be opened with the help of siege engines, so everything depended on storming the tunnel before it was too late. She leaned forward and followed the battle. It seemed to her that the groundlings were intent on beheading the invading orcs. Usually they concentrated on slashing their legs and shattering their kneecaps, allowing the maimed beasts to thrash about in agony and trip up their fellows. But this time, they were definitely aiming for their necks. She watched in amazement as orc after orc picked himself up from the ground and fought on.
What's going on? Are the beasts immortal?
She glanced at Ushnotz's corpse.
Is the Grey Range back in the grip of the perished land?
Another bugle sounded. This time the call came from a small band of dwarves emerging from a narrow opening near the waterfall. Onduri recognized their leader at once.
What's this? I saw him drown.
That's right,
bellowed Tungdil, his deep voice carrying over the din of clashing blades.
I've come to reclaim my property and avenge my friends. I won't rest until you're dead.
The dwarves, seeing their hero, were filled with new courage. The strength returned to their arms, and they fought back determinedly. The orcs responded by renewing their attack. It was clear to both sides that the battle had entered a crucial stage.
We'll see who gets vengeance, replied Onduri, trembling with rage. You'll die by the axe you forged.
Signalling to her companions to secure her path, she jumped into the melee of orcs. Parista, former realm of Leos Nudin, Girdlegard, spring, 6235th solar cycle. Namora kneeled down and drew her right hand over the loose, moist soil, then packed it down firmly.
Taken from me at birth, she whispered, tears leaking from her closed eyes. You started life together, and now you're alone. We won't forget you, I promise.
Wiping her cheeks with her sleeve, she opened her eyes and began to cover the little grave with stones. All alone in a forest beyond the walls of Parista, she took her leave from her son, burying his body, committing his soul to Samusin. It was an elvish ritual taught to her by her mother. No one else was there to mark the infant's passing. Fergus, the only person who could offer some solace, was in a deathly coma, leaving Namora alone in her grief. She was dreading the moment when she would tell her husband that their baby boy was dead.
What will I say?
She covered the grave with another layer of stones to protect the child from the claws and teeth of hungry scavengers. His body was tiny, but perfectly formed, with miniature fingers and toes, and an adorable face. Fate had ordained that he would never grow old. The hours wore on and the trees cast long shadows over the forest floor. At last, as dusk began to fall, she made her way back slowly to Parista. In the distance, the familiar landscape of scaffolding and cranes heralded the city's rise from the ashes, and the Maegar's palace loomed on the horizon, sable turrets reaching to the sky. Namora, head bowed, looked only at the ground. Blinded by grief, she entered the city, insensible to the activity on the crowded streets. In the marketplace, stalls were being dismantled, goods packed away, and coins counted into bags. People were leaving work, going home, piling into taverns that smelled of hot food or gathering on the pavements to discuss the latest news. Namora walked on. After a time, she became aware of the conversation around her. Everyone was talking excitedly about the deaths of Nodon's Famuli, Rodario's heroism, and the rapid construction of the city walls. "Next, they'll be gossiping about how I kill my child," she thought grimly. Andakai's intervention following Namora's botched incantation had prevented the two of them being crushed by the marble archway. But while a sprained ankle had been the only injury sustained by the Maga, Namora had paid with the life of her son. To her surprise, Rodario was waiting for her at the palace gates. Wrapping his arms around her, he hugged her in silence. Namora's eyes filled with tears all over again.
"Andukai told me what happened," he said sadly, trying not to look at her flat, childless belly. She looked exactly like the old Namora.
"I know," she said quickly, not wishing to discuss the baby's death. "The fireball robbed me of a son and left me with a daughter. When she's old enough, I'll tell her about her twin." She tried to meet Rodario's eyes, but he was looking at her strangely. "You're not in trouble again, are you?" she asked, guessing that he needed to get something off his chest. She mustered a faint smile. "Don't tell me that the hero of Perista is being chased by the angry father of some poor, impressionable girl." He looked at her warily. "We should talk somewhere else," he said, steering her back down the street. As they walked, he summarized how he had eavesdropped on the thieves and interrogated Nodon's Famula. His story was considerably more convoluted than the version that Namora had heard. "I don't know how to tell you this," he said carefully. "For all I know, the story was a fabrication. But the poor girl was dying, so I doubt she made it up." He hesitated, not wanting to add to his friend's distress. "Precious Namora." The half-elf glared at him. "This isn't one of your plays," she reminded him impatiently. "What did the Famula actually say? Are the villains who stabbed my Fergus still alive?" "That's just it," he said unhappily. "According to Nufa, the attack on Fergus had nothing to do with her. She said someone paid the ruffians to make it look like Nodon's Famuli were to blame." She seized him by the shoulders. "Speak clearly, Rodario. You're not making any sense." He took a deep breath, steeling himself for what would follow. "Nufa told me that she and her friends saw Andukai." All of a sudden, his face lit up with a radiant smile.
"Ah, there she is,"
he exclaimed, hailing the Maga with a wave.
"How reassuring for the citizens of Perista to know that Andukai the Tempestuous is patrolling the streets."
Namora eyed him intently. There was something insincere about his smile.
"Is Jerun with you, perchance?" he inquired, glancing about him.
The Maga went over to Namora.
"I was worried about you," she said, her face as stern as ever. "You were gone a long time, longer than expected. Your daughter won't stop crying. I'm many things, but I'm not a nurse."
"I'll be there right away," Namora promised.
"Well?"
she said, turning back to Rodario.
"You were saying?"
The impresario withered under Andakai's harsh gaze.
"I was telling Namora not to worry," he said quickly. "She's got nothing to fear now those villains are dead. Well, don't let me hold you up."
He yawned theatrically.
"It's nearly my bedtime. So much to do, so little time. May the gods be with you."
Hurrying away, he turned a corner and was gone. Namora shook her head in bemusement.
"Actress," she sighed.
Andukai just shrugged.
"The journey starts tomorrow. We'll head west and begin our search in the libraries of Wayern. Your daughter can join us, of course. I've hired a wet nurse to take care of her while I help you with your studies."
They walked for a while in silence.
"I hope you haven't changed your mind," said Andakai, gazing at the rows of buildings rising from the rubble. "Fergus's survival depends on you, remember?"
"I hate magic," said Namora fiercely. "Magic robbed me of my son. If it weren't for Fergus, I'd have nothing to do with it."
She glanced at the Maegar almost reproachfully.
"I know you were trying to help, but you shouldn't have made me your Fimula. It's bound to end badly."
She lowered her voice.
"It already has."
"From now on, you'll learn your formulae more carefully," said Andukai harshly. "I suffered losses when I was a Fimula as well."
Her stern face showed a flicker of emotion.
"I'm sorry I can't offer more comfort. Magic comes at a price."
They were almost at the palace.
"Perhaps the price is higher than we know," said Namora.
She recited the incantation to open the gates, and the two women, one dark-haired and slender, the other muscular and fair, walked in silence through the palace. On reaching the nursery, Namora went in and closed the door behind her, shutting the Maegar outside. At the sound of the door, the child woke up and let out a thin, piteous scream. Namora bent over the cot, scooped up the tiny baby, and clasped her to her breast, running her hands softly over her tiny head. The little girl's skull felt no stronger than an eggshell. Comforted by her mother's touch, Dorsa stopped crying. After the stillbirth of her son, Namora had been surprised by the arrival of a daughter. It hadn't occurred to her that she was carrying twins. But Samusin, god of equilibrium, had taken one of her children and let the other live. "What price must I pay for Fergus to get well?" The little baby made a clumsy attempt to suckle her breast.
"Are you thirsty, little one?" asked Namora.
She left the nursery, crossed the corridor, and knocked on the opposite door. It was opened by a young woman with bleary eyes and tousled hair. Namora held out her daughter.
"Dorsa needs feeding."
"Of course," murmured the girl, taking the baby tenderly and putting it to her breast. Dorsa took to her at once. The half-elf felt a pang of sadness as the wet nurse, singing softly, carried her baby around the room. With no milk of her own, she had to entrust her child to a stranger. Fortunately, there were plenty of young women in Perista who were happy to suckle her child in return for food or coin. As soon as the nurse had finished, Namora scooped up her baby and returned to the nursery. She held on to her for a while, cradling her to sleep, then replaced her in the cot, tucked her in, kissed her nose and stroked her downy head.
"Sweet dreams, my darling," she whispered. "I won't be long."
She slipped quietly out of the nursery and hurried to Fergus's room. For an hour she sat there, holding his clammy hand. Then she crept out of the palace to look for Rodario. She had no doubt that the impresario had a secret, and somehow or other, the Maegar was involved. Southern entrance to the Fifthling Kingdom. Girdlegard, spring, 6235th solar cycle. Leaping down from the boulder, the masked elf entered the scrum of armor, spears and swords and disappeared from view. Tungdil knew she wouldn't reappear until she was close enough to attack him, very probably from behind. It was like waiting for a serpent in a field of rippling grass. At the same time, he felt absurdly grateful. Vrakus had shown him that Keenfire wasn't lost.
"I need to kill the elf."
Boindil, his inner furnace blazing, banged his axes together impatiently.
"Thousands of fat, juicy orcs! My axes can't wait for a taste of their blood."
He glanced at Tungdil.
"Ready, scholar?"
Tungdil was watching the raging battle. The odds were in favor of the orcs, firstly because the dark water made them difficult to kill, and secondly because the dwarves had only a few hundred defenders. a fact that the orcs seemed thankfully slow to grasp. It was vital to close the gateway before the invaders gained more ground. So much for Glaimbar's tactics, thought Tongdil, allowing himself a moment of smugness.
All right, we need to head for the gateway, he told the others. Our priority is to close the gates. The beasts will never be able to force their way in.
Drawing his axe, he ran toward the charging orcs. Boindil, huffing disappointedly, took off at great speed.
Can't we just kill the lot of them?
He asked breathlessly, sprinting past Tongdil. He wasn't in the least bit intimidated by the raging beasts. Their snarling and grunting spurred him on.
The first 10 are mine, he shouted, raising his weapons.
His right axe sliced into a green-hided thigh, the left axe swinging upward to catch the falling orc. The blade passed effortlessly through the visor, releasing a torrent of green blood. The orc collapsed without a murmur, a third strike severing his neck.
Oink, oink,
snorted Ireheart, darting forward. He slashed a path through the hordes, allowing Tongdil, Mir, and the others to follow. Thanks to his sterling efforts, the group made rapid progress, and axes whirred in all directions, felling orc after orc. Killing the beasts posed a problem, because they had to be beheaded, which wasn't easy, especially since the dwarves were fighting several orcs at a time. After a while, they took to working in pairs, the first dwarf felling their opponents and the second dwarf driving his axe through their necks. All of a sudden, the gateway seemed much closer. The defending dwarfs, eager to help their former leader, sallied forth to meet him.
Get back!
Shrieked Tongdil as the Alfar leveled their bows.
Hold your shields above your heads, they'll...
Black arrows sang through the air, finding cracks in the wall of shields and homing in on unprotected flesh. Five dwarves fell to the ground and disappeared under the boots of the snarling orcs, who surged into the space, forming a living barrier between the gateway and the rest of the group. The defenders' maneuver had failed, leaving a handful of dwarfs at the entrance of the tunnel, while the others fought frantically to keep the orcs at bay. Dwarven archers raised their crossbows and fired bolts at the beasts, but the advance continued undeterred. The bolts were lethal for ordinary warriors, but not for a rabble of undead orcs.
We should have brought warriors, not masons and smiths, growled Ireheart, whirring his axe at giddying speed in an effort to reach the beleaguered defenders.
He was splattered from head to toe with green blood, which had an intimidating effect on the beasts.
Either that, or artisans who can fight.
His axes struck again. His victim, backing away nervously, took a blow to the neck. Tongdil tried to count the dwarves at the entrance to the tunnel. As far as he could tell, almost everyone in the kingdom had come out to beat back the invaders. But the orcs were still advancing and had nearly reached their goal. Tongdil spotted Glaimbar and Belindis fighting side by side. He pointed to the survivors of the ill-advised sally.
Head toward them, he commanded. If we band together, we'll make it to the gates.
Out of the corner of his eye, he noticed that Mir and the exiles were holding their own against the orcs. In fact, the dainty medic was fighting with tenacity and strength. Soon, Tongdil's party joined the band of defenders, but their path was blocked. The beasts surged forward, spurred on by Runshak, who was bawling orders at the top of his voice. The Alfar feathered the troopers with arrows, driving them on from behind. Yelping with pain, the orcs advanced. Victory was in their grasp. In front of the gateway, the lead orcs were locked in combat with the dwarfs, who were fighting valiantly but ineffectually against the invaders. Meanwhile, some of the smaller orcs were trying to sneak past and attack from behind, trapping the defenders between two fronts. Tongdil glanced at the orcish leader.
It's time he went, he said, deciding that a change of tactics was in order. We need to kill their chief.
Ironheart, brown eyes glinting manically, had fought himself into a frenzy. At the mercy of his fiery spirit, he threw himself on the enemy, windmilling his axes at incredible speed.
Boindil! Shouted Tungdil. I said we need to kill their chief!
He had to repeat himself several more times before Boindil finally heard. The group set off toward Runshak, who spotted the approaching threat and turned to the Alfar, hoping to enlist their bows in his defense. Suddenly his grin froze, his mouth falling open in horror. Tungdil saw the fear on his ugly green face and turned to discover its source. A colossal figure loomed into view, brandishing a sword in one hand and an axe in the other. The metal-clad giant towered over the boulder where the Alfar was stationed with their bows. The orcs in the vicinity squealed in terror and scattered in all directions, falling over each other in their eagerness to escape. A demonic visage stared out from the giant's visor, the eyeholes emitting a bright purple light. Even from a distance, Tungdil's eyes were dazzled. The giant let out a dull, menacing roar that caused the ground to quake. Tungdil's hair stood on end. Alerted to the danger, the Alfar raised their bows. But Jerun was already upon them, sword and axe slashing through the air, severing bowstrings, cleaving arrows, and slicing through sinew and bone. In no time, the boulder was strewn with bloodied armor and gory remains. Only one of the Alfar succeeded in evading Jerun's blades, but the colossal warrior had no intention of letting him escape. Jumping onto the boulder, he pushed off and launched himself into the air, landing on the shoulders of the fleeing Alf, who crumpled screaming to the ground. Without stopping to use his weapons, Jerun stamped on his head, squashing it like a plum. A tense silence descended on the plateau. Both sides had watched the encounter with bated breath.
This is our chance!
Wrenching his eyes away from Jerun, Tungdil aimed his axe at the orcish chieftain and hurled it at his head. Runshak heard the weapon whir toward him and turned in time for the blade to miss the back of his helmet and land between his jaws, slicing cleanly through his head. The newly appointed chieftain was dead.
"For Vrakus and Gerdlegard!"
shouted Tungdil, breaking the hush.
"Behead the brutes! Long live the children of the smith!"
The orcs had heard and seen enough. After losing their unbidden allies, not to mention Runshak and the prince, the beasts were ready to admit defeat. Forgetting their undead powers, they forfeited their advantage and fled. The panic was so great that some of them jumped on top of their spluttering comrades in the pool, while others stampeded down the mountainside, bowling over the troopers who were toiling to the top.
"You never learn, do you, scholar?" scolded Boindil, handing Tungdil one of his axes. "What was the first thing I taught you? Never throw your axe unless you've got another in reserve."
He grinned.
"Still, there's nothing wrong with your aim."
Oinking ferociously, he threw himself on the fleeing troopers, slaying orc after orc. Cries of astonishment went up from both sides as a second battalion of dwarfs appeared on the far side of the plateau. The new arrivals threw themselves on the invaders, squeezing the orcs between two fronts. Tungdil noticed that some of the warriors had white hair and pale skin.
"The freelings," he thought, relieved.
Although the tide had turned in favor of the defenders, there was a chance that the orcs would remember their immortality and lay siege to the gates. Gemmell's warriors couldn't have arrived at a better time.
"This is the crunch," he thought, glancing to where Glaimbar and Belindis were fighting.
The king and his fiancée were defending the gateway against a handful of orcs whose fury outweighed their fear. Far gone in bloodlust, The beasts threw themselves against the defenders' axes, hammers and clubs. Most of Tungdil's comrades were too busy chasing the fleeing army to realize that the gateway's last defenders were dangerously overextended. Tungdil paused, his thoughts in turmoil, as he watched his rival parry blow after blow. The attack redoubled, but Glaimbar was holding his own. Just.
"It's nothing to do with you," whispered a devilish voice in his head. "So what if he falls? He'll die a hero and Belindus will be free."
The chosen leader of the Fifthlings took a step backward and came up against a wall. For a second he was distracted and an orcish sword made contact with his wrist.
"Glaimbar can take care of himself," the voice whispered. "He's a great warrior. Let him prove his worth. Hurry up and find Boindil."
Tungdil had almost decided to rejoin his group when Belindus caught his eye. She was surrounded by orcs, and she looked at Tungdil pleadingly, her brown eyes begging him to go to Glaimbar's aid.
"Botheration," he grumbled, gripping the haft of his axe. "What a pity it was his wrist, not his chest."
He set off bad-temperedly toward the gateway, but the rescue mission came to a precipitous end. In the heat of the battle, he had forgotten to look out for the elf. A slender figure appeared out of nowhere and alighted beside him. Looking up, he saw Keenfire speeding toward his head. Chapter 8 Black Saddle, Kingdom of Goregar, Girdlegard, Spring 6235th Solar Cycle. The diamonds on the High King's helmet glinted in the sun. Gandogar knew that even the most short-sighted sentry would notice his approach. But he held his head high. He wanted to be seen. In all his 299 cycles, he had never set eyes on the Thirdling King, and his arrival at the court of Lorimbas marked a turning point in the history of the dwarves. Pushing the brown hair away from his eyes, he looked up at the black saddle and watched as sun and shadow strove for mastery over its slopes. The gullies and couloirs were shrouded in inky darkness, but the flanks of the mountain were gilded with light. For Gandagar there was something menacing about the flat-top mountain where countless dwarves, elves and men had lost their lives.
"The battle has left its mark on this place."
He shook the reins and the pony moved off. The powerful dwarf and his mount were suffering from their long journey through Sangpur's deserts. Particles of sand had found their way into Gandagar's beard, slipped through the rings of his mail, and sneaked inside his leather jerkin, rubbing against his skin in the tenderest places. His poor pony had fared no better. There was no escape from Sangpur's sand. Now, as they rode through southern Goregar, the temperature was cooler, but the air was thick with menace. The banners flying from the top of the black saddle warned the High King and his 50 armed warriors that the stronghold was in the hands of its makers, the children of Lorimbur. Bones crunched beneath the pony's hooves. No one had buried the dead beasts after the battle. Their corpses had been eaten by predators or piled up and burned. Sun, rain, and snow would take care of their skeletons, but for now their remains lay strewn at the base of the mountain, warning travelers not to linger in this place. Second in the procession was Belendalin, king of Berowyn's folk. He had joined the expedition after Gandogar accepted his offer of advice and support. His gaze was fixed on the mountain ahead.
"Should we mourn our fallen comrades, or celebrate the joint victory of dwarves, elves, and men?"
he asked pensively.
"There's never been a battle like it. The massed ranks of Nodon's army against the armies of Girdlegard, with the dwarfs at the fore."
"Let's hope the alliance lasts," said Gandagar fervently.
"We can't let the Thirdlings shatter our newly forged bonds."
With a sigh, the one-armed king looked up at the fluttering banners.
I wonder how the mountain feels about the return of the dwarves who plundered its gold.
Bruron had no choice but to cede the stronghold to Lorimbas, replied Gandugar evenly. According to his envoy, Gurugar was bound by the terms of an ancient treaty.
No choice, objected Belendolin. What does Bruron owe the Thirdlings?
Malin is reliant on Thirdling mercenaries, but he refused to surrender to Lorimbas's demands. I'll wager my one good arm that Bruron was bribed.
Gandugar tugged on the reins, steering the pony to the right of an ogre skull that was blocking their path. The stripped bone bristled with broken spears and arrow shafts, and the crown of the head provided the birds with a useful platform as they scanned the path for dung.
You're probably right, said the king of all dwarves. And that's precisely why a diplomatic solution is called for. Gerdlegard won't be at peace until we put an end to this senseless feud.
He glanced at Belendolin.
I thought you were supposed to be the voice of reason. Are you suggesting we kill him?
Vrakus would roast my soul in his furnace if such a thought were to enter my mind, said the secondling, laughing.
His expression became grave.
No, Gandugar, neither of us are dwarf killers. Although I can't say Lorimbas deserves our mercy. His machinations are undermining our alliance with the elves and men.
He held the king's gaze.
The question is, how are you going to stop him?
We haven't spoken to the Thirdlings for hundreds of cycles, so the usual sanctions won't work.
That's why we need to talk to them, said Gandagar firmly. I understand your reservations, but Lorimbas and I will find a way of making peace.
A door came into view at the base of the mountain. In earlier cycles, it had been concealed by conifers, each standing 50 paces tall. But the orcs had cut down the forest to make siege engines and ladders. After the battle, the wood had served as kindling for the biggest funeral pyre in Gerdlegard's history, on which the corpses of the beasts had been burned. All that remained was a multitude of stumps.
I'm not naive enough to think we'll ever be friends with the Thirdlings, continued Gandagar,
realizing that the secondling leader was unconvinced.
But it's time we put a stop to the feuding and treated each other with a little respect.
Belendolin clicked his tongue doubtfully.
By the hammer of Vrakus! I wish I could knock some sense into their heads.
They drew up outside the door. Barring their way were 20 warriors with long-handled pikes, the tips of which were pointing menacingly at the riders.
Stop!
Commanded a broad-chested Thirdling, fingering his morning star. His face was covered in tattoos.
My name is Romo Steelheart of the Clan of the Stonegrinders, nephew of King Lorimbas.
He measured the High King with his gaze.
I suppose you must be Gandugar, he said,
denying him the usual courtesies extended to a dwarven king. Belendolin studied the Thirdling's face. Tattooed runes spoke of his eternal hatred of the four dwarven folks, promising death and damnation to the descendants of Berowin, Boringar, Giselbert, and Goimdil. The sinister effect of the tattooist's artwork was heightened by the hostility in Romo's eyes. Belendolin had no doubt that he was looking at the face of a zealous dwarf killer.
My name is Gandugar Silverbeard of the Clan of the Silverbeards, head of Goimdil's line, said the High King. My business is with your...
Romo snorted derisively, and a globule of snot hit the ground by Gandugar's feet.
Gandugar can come in. The rest of you, wait outside.
Belendolin was unmoved.
The High King goes nowhere without his escort. If this is your tone, you can forgive our suspicions.
Romo shrugged
armor clunking.
"It's him or no one," he said sharply. "Those are my orders. If you don't like them, you can leave."
A sneer spread over his face.
"Oh, I should have realized. Poor Gandogar is scared."